So glad you're here. I'm Julie Ballou, and this is Rape the Podcast. I went with what I thought was a powerful name that tells the subject matter without beating around the bush. When I started researching how this topic is covered in other podcasts, I had a difficult time finding anything. Typing rape and sexual assault into the search bar, there really aren't many with rape in the title that I could find. But there are many very helpful and informative podcasts if you look hard enough. I think there needs to be more. We are talking about rape in this podcast series. You will hear about sexual violence and child abuse. If you or someone you know needs help sorting out something that's happened and you find this podcast bringing up stuff that you weren't prepared to deal with, or if you need resources, you can call 1-800-656-HOPE. Rape, sexual assault, sexual violence, child abuse. These are terms that are easier to talk about now than they used to be, but we have so much further to go before victims can stop being afraid to talk about what has personally happened to them. Let's find ways to break down the stigma of these events so that we can heal ourselves by talking about it, not being afraid, not being ashamed. What if the rapists of the world learn that we are educating ourselves on the ways to go about getting justice and ultimately making rape something that just doesn't happen that often? We aren't going to be afraid anymore. A couple of things. I'm Julie Ballou, and I have secrets, like many of us, that I'm not ready to share, but I have personal experience with surviving rape. Other than a few therapy sessions where memories came flooding back to me, I really haven't dealt with it, and I don't plan to unload on this podcast. But you never know. I can tell you that the main reason I don't want to share my stories is because I don't want to embarrass my family that I hardly talk to. But my current close, supportive family is filled with young women who I deeply care about. I love them. 1 in 6 women are raped. So let me be the one who's the sixth. This statistic makes me think about the time I was getting a mammogram at the insistence of my doctor because of a very suspicious lump. Friends told me not to worry because 7 out of 8 suspicious lumps are benign. The amount of worry that statistic gave me was impounded when I learned I had stage 3 breast cancer. But I did what I had to do, and here I am 6 years later, cancer-free. The other thing is that I'm not from Springfield, Missouri. Well, I am now, but I moved here from Atlanta, Georgia in 1995. I had culture shock for the first 10 years because this town is so freaking white. It's white and conservative as much as any small town in the Midwest can be. In Springfield, diversity is a challenge. At first, I really felt like I could leave my doors unlocked and everything was safe. Then in the late 1990s, Missouri blossomed into the meth capital of the world. Look it up. So I don't feel as safe as I used to. We now have 4.4% of both blacks and Latinos out of a town of about 190,000 people. When I first moved here, I lived pretty close to downtown. I was a radio DJ, so I used to use that to my benefit to get to see as many free concerts as some of the cool music venues downtown. There is a music scene in Springfield, Missouri. As a matter of fact, it's quite actually the birthplace of country music. Anyway, I recommend you tune in to my friend Dale Wiley's podcast called Missouri Music Podcast. There's a link on my website. Essentially, there was a national network television show broadcast from the Jewel Theater in downtown Springfield called the Ozark Mountain Jubilee. It brought all kinds of business here in the 1950s. Springfield is also proud to be the birthplace of Brad Pitt and Cashew Chicken. My Atlanta friends used to make fun of Springfield's diversity festivals and joke, Springfield, where diversity is just a word. Isn't that terrible? The Assemblies of God Church practically runs the town when it comes to morality. Their headquarters are here, and their churches are spread out all over the area with monster churches. Pastor at James River Assemblies of God recently instructed his members that yoga was created with demonic intent to open you up to demonic power. So there is a very conservative stronghold on the Springfield community. That's what I'm trying to tell you. With not much diversity. And a whole lot of meth. Let's run through some statistics I found at RAIN.org. Every 73 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted, and every 9 minutes, that victim is a child. Meanwhile, only 5 out of every 1,000 perpetrators will end up in prison. That's fucked up. I was scrolling through my Facebook feed on Thursday, November 29th, 2018, when a story came across my feed.
An article by CNN is circulating in the Ozarks. The scathing report shines the light on Springfield's police department in its handling of rape cases.
That CNN report claims journalists reviewed nearly 200 investigations in which Springfield police destroyed rape kits since 2010 and found more than half of the kits were actually destroyed before the statutes of limitations expired. 75% of them destroyed before they were even ever sent to a lab for testing.
For his part, Chief Paul Williams of the police department acknowledged mistakes in rape investigations in the past and says the department's practices have changed.
My friends and I thought it was weird that CNN had to break the story. How does this all of a sudden become national news when it appeared that no one really knew about it around here until now? How rape cases went wrong. Police files show flawed investigations led to the trashing of evidence, headlined the collection of articles written by CNN investigative journalist Ashley Franz, Simon Vashi, and Sergio Hernandez. The story was only featured on their website. It wasn't on the TV. It features a short animated video on the page with the main title, Destroyed. I wish I knew who to attribute this video to, but it tells a chilling story.
Hours after you are raped, you sit in a hospital room under fluorescent lights and consent to a forensic exam. Your body is the crime scene. A nurse asks, "When did it happen? Where did it happen? Did he ejaculate inside of you, on you? Did he kiss you, lick you? Did you shower?" The nurse says she needs to know every detail of your assault so she can examine you. You're asked to undress slowly while you stand on a special sheet meant to collect any trace evidence that shakes loose. For 3 to 5 hours, the nurse swabs your mouth, your breasts, the bite mark on your neck. She scrapes under your fingernails, combs your pubic hair. She inserts a speculum inside you and uses blue dye to illuminate places that are torn. The nurse cuts a hair from your head. She takes photographs of every injury, from far away and close up, using a ruler to show size. When the exam is over, the evidence goes in a container smaller than a shoebox. This is your rape kit. This is what you endure to get justice. No one tells you that the exam may be pointless, that police might treat your rape kit like trash.
CNN followed up with an article singling out Springfield, Missouri's treatment of one case in particular. The story goes like this. Woman reports to Springfield, Missouri police that a man named Mo, she'd known about a day, locked her in a room and threw her down on a bed. The case file says in the evening of July 15th, 2009, Detective Geiger was dispatched to Cox South in reference to a past rape that occurred to interview the victim in the process of a rape exam. She said that at about 1 a.m. earlier that day, she'd been hanging out with friends at a neighbor's apartment when she left to get cigarettes from her room, and a guy she knew as Mo followed her and managed to walk into her apartment right behind her. It goes on to say Mo told her he wanted to talk to her, but she told him that she needed to get the keys back up to her roommate, who was still at the neighbor's, and she told Mo she was leaving. But Mo turned around and locked the deadbolt. She texted her roommate to come down to their apartment, to which the roommate responded, "Why should I?" She told the officer they'd been in an argument earlier. Mo then grabbed is in quotations in the original report. Mo then, quote, grabbed, unquote, her by the arms and, quote, threw, unquote, her on the bed. Mo got on top of her and held her down. She said she could not move and she was yelling at Mo. Then Mo took her pants off and then her underwear and then her shirt. She said Mo undressed and pulled her legs apart roughly and pushed it in. Detective Geiger states in the report that he asked her to clarify this, and she said that Mo had penetrated her with his penis. She said he was not wearing a condom, and this went on for about 15 minutes, saying she was yelling, quote, no, unquote, at him. She said she was able to text her roommate again to come help her. He complied this time and came down to the apartment and started banging on the door. Mo got up and went to the door, holding it closed and saying, just give me 20 more minutes. The roommate left and came back after a while with two other people that she didn't really know very well. This time, the roommate was able to get in. She ran into the bathroom to get some clothes on and then ran outside crying. Mo then got dressed and left. At this point, the victim tells investigators that Mo had never ejaculated. The victim had not called earlier because she was scared, but her mother convinced her to report it. She described Mo as a dark-skinned black male, around 22 years of age. He was around 6'1" and weighed over 200 pounds. She thought he was wearing a black Scarface t-shirt and black shorts, and she thought he lived somewhere in the building where this had occurred. The report goes on with the investigator's interview with the roommate, who collaborated everything. The sexual assault nurse examiner told police that she had seen no signs of bruising or lacerations to the victim's vaginal area or to the rest of her body. The nurse turned the rape kit over to Detective Geiger, which she had sealed with the evidence tape provided, as well as a blood and urine sample. These items are later logged into the property room as evidence. After she was released, the detectives followed her to her apartment to collect evidence. They consented for the investigators to be able to remove any evidence that might be related. The report mentions that the consent to search form was later logged into the property room as evidence. They collect the bed sheet and the clothing she was wearing, which consisted of a pair of jeans, a blue shirt, and her panties, which were all logged into the property room as evidence. The victim was provided with the report number, Detective Geiger's name, and badge number, along with the victim and witness pamphlet. The investigators asked around about Mo and learned about which building he lived in. His real name was David, and that's as far as they got. He was not contacted. Shortly before that horrendous day was over, police were called back to the victim's apartment. In the supplemental report, a Detective Conklin walks to the front door of the apartment and sees a liquid substance on the door as if a male urinated on the door. The liquid was on the door handle and ran down the door because it had not had time to evaporate. So yeah, he pissed on the door. The next day, with all of this evidence, Detective Maggie McDowell was assigned to handle the investigation. She calls the victim and leaves a message, and then she immediately sends out a letter. The letter states, if the victim did not contact the detective within 10 business days from the date of the letter, then the case would be closed and receive no further investigation. CNN quoted a sex crimes investigator who said, this 10-day letter tactic is used sometimes by police for non-violent offenses like someone's car is broken into. 2 weeks after the letter was sent to the victim, the detective calls a second time and leaves a message to let her know if she does not wish to pursue an investigation. 2 weeks after that, the case is closed. And another letter goes out that says, her failure to cooperate was the reason that no more work could be done. 3 days after that, the case is closed. And before the period of time when any legal action could be brought in this case, otherwise known as the statute of limitations, a request goes out to destroy the rape kit. You need to learn about some of the other cases across the United States the reporters uncovered. So please read the article that I've linked at rapethepodcast.com. I would like to suggest that if you report a rape to the Springfield Police Department, that you would be amazed at how respectful the trauma-informed police officers will treat you, how advocates will be with you every step of the way, and your chance for justice and maybe even closure will prevail. Do you see how fucking positive I am? But I don't know what's going to happen now. I quit bothering Me Too Springfield, the prosecuting attorney's office, the original CNN reporters, and the chief of police when COVID hit us all like a hammer. And I thought I'd be able to release this podcast in April of 2020, but you know how that goes. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The only awareness I heard being promoted was the fact that domestic violence increased when certain mismatched people had to stay in their homes together during quarantine. My real essential occupation was paralegal at a family law firm. I was slammed with calls for domestic problems, from divorce to custody problems, out the wazoo. Now that it's time to take back control of my life, long story, different podcast, I'm exposing the story behind the story. Mind you, I'm not a real reporter. I'm a mom in a community hoping for a good outcome. What has been done since this article came out? Well, the Springfield police got together with Me Too Springfield and some of the advocates from around our area, and the city council initiated a sexual assault task force. In the next episode, we will talk with survivors of rape and domestic violence, but I could still use your help. If you have a story to tell, no matter where you live, I'd love for you to share it with me. We've all heard that talking about it is therapeutic and will certainly help others who can relate to your experience. Please contact me via Facebook or the website, by email or by phone. You can be anonymous and tell as little or as much as you like. My wish is that we all find it easier to discuss what happened to us and not be afraid of embarrassment, or that people won't believe you, or that if you talk too much about it, that it or he will come after you. I want my daughters to feel secure and protected if the worst was to happen. For more guidance and help for you or someone you know, call 1-800-656-HOPE. Thank you for joining me. Until next time, I'm Julie Ballou, and this has been Rape the Podcast.